Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with an examination of some of the major 20th century capital flows, which not only led to the growth and establishment of fascism in Europe in the pre-World War II period, but which have also manifested themselves in the post-World War II period in such a way as to revive fascism, or perhaps perpetuate fascism would be a better term. And I'm going into these capital flows in part to provide some understanding for some of the things that I've been speaking about in recent months, in particular the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, and also the Nazi book Serpent's Walk about the SS going underground, building up their economic muscle, taking over the U.S. opinion-forming media, infiltrating the U.S. Army, and after an attack by genetically engineered viruses of ostensible Russian origin, the SS then, those attacks, by the way, kill the president and vice president, the SS then takes over the United States, courtesy of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who was a Nazi ally. I've gone into both the Bormann Organization and the book Serpent's Walk in past half-hour segments. We're going to turn once again for our discussion of the second of the major capital flows that we're talking about, namely the flow of capital from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe during World War II into the coffers of the Third Reich. The second major capital flow was accomplished by the Nazis utilizing bank clearing and currency rate exchange mechanisms, and one of the key institutions involved with this was the Bank for International Settlements, staffed in considerable measure by some of the American branch, the American participants in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. We're going to turn once again to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, that we were using in the first half-hour segment. Of these complicated bank clearing procedures and exchange rate mechanisms that were used by the Third Reich to loot the coffers of the occupied countries of Europe, the second of the major capital flows that we're looking at, Simpson writes as follows. In Belgium, for example, the Nazi occupation government declared the German currency, the Reichsmark, to be worth 12.5 Belgian francs. This rate overvalued the mark by as much as 50%, making everything in Belgium extraordinarily cheap for Germans. Next, the puppet Belgian government decreed that all trade with Germany or with the occupation government was required to use a special currency designed for German use in the occupied countries. In effect, Germany created a new type of money in Belgium and throughout Nazi-occupied Europe that it could print and spend at will. When it came time to settle up between the Reichsbank and the Foreign Central Bank, the Reichsbank again enlisted the cooperation of the Bank for International Settlements in putting forward a variety of pretexts not to pay its debt. The occupied country was powerless to resist. Skipping down, soon German banks and companies began buying up foreign companies, real estate, products, and raw materials all across Europe for a fraction of their value. Such transactions were usually completed, quote, legally, unquote, with all of the contracts, deeds, and other documentation typical of conventional business. Meanwhile, those aspects of the economies in the occupied countries that were not dependent upon sales to Germany disintegrated. This was extremely profitable for the German companies, of course, and presented a major inducement for some business people to collaborate with the occupation. The post-war coalition government in Poland estimated that this type of theft had cost their country the equivalent of 20 billion marks between 1939 and 1945, equal to about 17% of Germany's total annual war budget at the height of the conflict in Europe. While these numbers are an estimate, and the Polish government obviously had an interest in claiming a high level of damages, they nonetheless illustrate the effectiveness of this technique of draining wealth from occupied countries. A study by the British Ministry of Economic Warfare reported damages consistent with the Polish estimates and roughly proportionate figures for eight other countries occupied by Germany. In all, the British estimated that the Germans had extracted the equivalent of about $180 billion from occupied Europe as of 1943, including both direct levies for occupation costs and a variety of hidden techniques such as currency manipulation. These figures were based on financial statistics published by the Germans themselves and do not include estimates for wealth seized from the USSR and Greece. As such, even the $180 billion figure clearly underestimates the true total. And that, of course, was only up to 1943. Continuing, the Bank for International Settlements cooperated with and facilitated this scheme, despite protests from exiled Allied governments. The bank recognized the Nazi-installed occupation governments provided the clearing service as essential to, quote, legalizing, unquote, the operation, and even went so far as to help Nazi leaders such as Walter Funk unload looted gold in international markets. And so that is the second of the major capital flows, the first one being a major capital flow from the booming U.S. of the 1920s to Europe and Germany in particular to build up the industry that not only was the backbone of Hitler's war-making capacity, but which elevated Hitler to power in the first place. As the war began to go badly for Germany, one of the things that I talked about in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program alluded to earlier, namely the Himmlerkreis or Himmler's Circle of Friends, key German industrialists whose contributions financed the day-to-day operations of the SS and who in turn got the pick of the SS slave labor pool to use in their industrial operations, the Himmlerkreis, who embodied many of the industrialists who formulated the policy that was realized with the looting scheme that I just detailed, namely using German arms to conquer countries which would then have their economies restructured in such a way as to favor German corporate interests who would then re-enter the world market. Many of these same industrialists and these corporatists that I alluded to earlier and whose strategy and the realization of whose strategy I just talked about were key members of the Himmlerkreis, and they in turn began putting together bodies which began actively collaborating or that actively cooperated with the American branch or members of the American branch of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis to perpetuate the German industrial elite after World War II. Christopher Simpson writes about this in The Splendid Blonde Beast as follows. The notorious Himmlerkreis, the circle of friends of Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler, is a good example of the dynamics of Germany's high-level business networks during the decline of the Third Reich. The Nazis and leading German businessmen had jointly created the Himmlerkreis in the early 1930s as an informal communication link between the financial and industrial elite and the SS. Himmler sought the political and economic support of the business elite, and the elite in turn sought influence outside of official channels with the increasingly powerful police leader, skipping down. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the BRABAG Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss, BRABAG Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Holt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board. Officially, the Himmlerkreis meetings were not for conducting business, because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounters served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. I.G. Farben appears to have used Himmlerkreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmlerkreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best-known of these groups, the Arbeitskreis für Außenwirtschaftliche Fragen, the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions, and the Kleiner Arbeitskreis, or Small Working Group, were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industrie, Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. They brought together Blessing, Rasche, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmlerkreis, with other business people such as Hermann Obbs of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industrie and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, Ludger Westrich, RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, and Philip Reimstra, Tobacco, Shipping, and Banking, with Nazi business specialists such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kerl, SS business specialist. By the way, take note of one of the key participants in the Himmler Kreis groups that Chris Simpson's talking about here, namely Ludwig Erhard. He was not only Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor and the economic minister of Adenauer's Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany. He later succeeded Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany and was the key architect of post-war German economic recovery. And note his position here working with the Himmler Kreis. Continuing. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, OBS, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier. By the way, that corporatist policy for conquest was realized in the second major capital flow, the looting of the coffers of occupied nations that we just discussed. What we're going to look at next is the third major capital flow, and this comes directly from the events that we've laid the that we've already discussed. Those could be thought of as the foundation for this, and this next major capital flow is the flow of capital from the declining Nazi Empire into 750 corporate fronts that were established in neutral countries. This flight capital organization is the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I've spoken about many times in the past, an institution that I think will ultimately prove to be the deciding element in human affairs on this planet. And in taking a look at this third major capital flow, the flow of capital from Nazi-occupied Europe into the 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries, we're going to once again rely on the definitive text about the Bormann organization, a brilliant and heroic book authored by Paul Manning. Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. And in 1981, he published a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. That book was published in hardcover and softcover by Lyle Stewart Press, and the ISBN number is 0-8184-0309-8. And of the third major capital flow, the flow of capital into the 750 corporate fronts established in neutral countries for the Bormann Flight Capital Program, Manning writes as follows. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the directions of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz of IG Farben. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows: Portugal, 58, Spain, 112, Sweden, 233, Switzerland, 214, Turkey, 35, and Argentina, 98. And the flow of capital from occupied Europe into the 750 corporate fronts is the third of the major capital flows in this hydraulic model that we're looking at. What we're going to look at next is the role of some of the American, key American members of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, both the Wall Street faction and the Regis State Department faction, in perpetuating this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, sustaining the German industrial and financial elite, the German end of this axis and their associates, and ultimately affecting the next major capital flow number four, which was the Marshall Plan, the 50th anniversary of which was recently observed and celebrated, as I speak, in late June of 1998. We took a look at the Regis faction of the State Department, and Robert Murphy of the State Department was one of the key Regis faction members who helped to sustain and restore the German financial and industrial elite to power after World War II. Speaking of denazification, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast, "But a written policy, that being denazification, is one thing. Its implementation is quite another. State Department's Robert Murphy took personal charge of the political oversight of U.S. denazification work in Germany almost immediately, and he made little secret of his inclinations. Meanwhile, the sensitive task of overseeing U.S. intelligence evaluations of German business and political leaders fell to an enterprising OSS man who was stationed in Berlin shortly after Hitler's suicide. That man was Alan Dulles. As we've seen, Alan Dulles was, along with his partner, his brother John Foster Dulles, a partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, one of the key players in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis and the resulting capital flows. Of Dulles and his work in Berlin, Simpson writes as follows in Splendid Blonde Beast. Dulles became one of Robert Murphy's most strategically placed allies inside occupied Germany. Beginning in early 1945, Dulles provided clearances for senior German bankers and industrialists seeking permission to remain active in Germany's post-war economy. As an OSS chief in Allied occupied Berlin, he personally oversaw compilation of white lists, unquote, of non-Nazi German executives believed to be useful for German reconstruction. He thus exercised considerable influence during the first months of the war over the day-to-day implementation of U.S. policy concerning German business leaders. And with the aforementioned Robert Murphy, and also with William Draper, one of the key officials from Dillon Reed that we looked at in our first segment, Alan Dulles was instrumental in perpetuating the position of the German end of this axis in power in the post-World War II period. William Draper of Dillon Reed became General William Draper and was one of the key military officials overseeing German reconstruction. Of William Draper, Christopher Simpson writes, Dillon Reed and company partner William Draper became pivotal to the semi-clandestine shift in U.S. policy toward Germany that summer. By 1945, Secretary of War Stimson and Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, Dillon Reed's former president, engineered Draper's appointment as Chief of the Economic Division of the Joint Allied Control Council for Germany, the Central Occupation Government at the time, and as Director of Economic Policy for the German territories administered by the U.S. As such, Draper emerged as by far the most powerful U.S. industrial and finance official in occupied Germany, with overall authority for implementing Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive 1067 and other U.S. denazification programs aimed at German bankers and businessmen. Draper was an imposing, broad-chested man with a bald pate of dark, bristling eyebrows that emphasized his high forehead. Prior to the war, he had been corporate treasurer at Dillon Reed and an officer of the German Credit and Investment Corporation of New Jersey, a Dillon Reed-sponsored holding company that specialized in international investments in Hitler-era Germany. As should not be surprising, with people like Robert Murphy of the State Department, people like Alan Dulles working in the intelligence community, and people like William Draper overseeing the actual occupation of Germany, the reinstitution, or the perpetuation, really would be a better way of putting it, of the German financial and industrial elite, the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, was assured and, in fact, took place. Denazification was tossed out the window and replaced by a policy very similar to the policy endorsed by the Rege faction and their allies on Wall Street of building up German industry as a bulwark against not only the Soviet Union but the possibility of revolution in Central or Eastern Europe. Of the frustration of denazification, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. But at least as early as December of 1945, the opposite formulation came to the fore, even in official documents. Now, it was the denazification effort that was seen as the source of disaffection. Opposition within the U.S. to denazification and decartelization in Germany was led almost exclusively by the corporate and foreign policy elite that had been most active in U.S.-German financial relations during the 1920s and 1930s. The disproportionate political leverage of this group, its ability to shape media coverage of foreign policy issues, to influence government policy, and eventually to shift public opinion was dramatically manifested in the realignment of U.S. policy concerning denazification and decartelization in the brief period between 1945 and 1947. One of this group's most effective lobbying tactics was sponsorship of junkets to Europe by American politicians and businessmen financed by U.S. multinationals to, quote, study the problem of German recovery, unquote. Draper paid close attention to these visits, staging elaborate briefings intended to shape public opinion at home concerning the professional realities of business in Europe. These events were almost ceremonial. The attendees and the briefers had selected one another largely through their existing social networks based in powerful U.S. companies with investments in Europe. The men on both sides of Draper's briefing table were receptive to his message and usually knew pretty well what it would be. The next major capital flow, the fourth capital flow that we're going to look at, concerns the flow of capital once again from North America to Europe, Germany in particular. And this capital flow took place under the Marshall Plan, the 50th anniversary of which was just celebrated, again, as I speak, in late June of 1998. Now, the Brown referred to here is a Lewis H. Brown, who wrote a book advocating the perpetuation of the economic status quo in Germany and the perpetuation of the German business elite in positions of power. Philip Reed, or the Reed referred to here as Philip Reed of General Electric, one of the major U.S. corporations that was a player on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. The two of them lobbied for the European Recovery Plan, popularly known as the Marshall Plan, which is the fourth major capital flow that we're going to be looking at in these segments. Turning once again to the splendid blonde beast, Christopher Simpson writes as follows, "The reports of Brown and Reed were in reality briefs for the European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan. They illustrate the extent to which that enormously popular and respected program became entangled with the revival of German businessmen who had participated in Nazi crimes. Particularly important in this effort was the, quote, Committee for the Marshall Plan, unquote, founded in September of 1947. It labeled itself a citizens' organization, but was in reality funded and administered by the same economic and foreign policy elite that has been discussed thus far. Its initial sponsors included Averell Harriman and Robert Levitt, who will be remembered from the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank, Alan Dulles, Dean Acheson, Winthrop Aldrich, chairman of the Chase Bank, Philip Reed of General Electric, and others of similar stature, most of whom had been active in U.S.-German finance since the 1920s. Labor was represented by hardline anti-communists active in the CIA-sponsored penetration of European trade unions, such as James Carey and David Dubinsky. The Marshall Plan operated as a, quote, distinguished propaganda committee, unquote, as AT&T executive Arthur Page described it. Its goal was never described as the revitalization of the German business elite, but rather as, quote, saving Europe, unquote, and, quote, providing American jobs, unquote, through implementation of the Marshall Plan. But whatever one may think of the plan, the restoration of much of the pre-war German corporate elite was an integral part of the package. General Clay used the case of Deutsche Bank director Hermann Abs to explain this concept. Quote, we were never able to make Hermann Abs the financial minister of Germany as we would have, unquote, Clay remembered in the same interview quoted earlier, because of the German and American public's refusal to accept a man who had been so deeply compromised during the Hitler years. But not to worry, Clay continued, again quoting, we were able to finally put him in charge of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was somewhat outside of government, unquote, and which was instrumental in distribution of Marshall Plan funds for Germany. Sponsors of the Committee for the Marshall Plan were simultaneously at the cutting edge of renewed efforts to invest in German industry. Quote, if you have been trying unsuccessfully to get to Germany to reestablish pre-war business contacts, don't be discouraged, unquote, Business Week told its readers in early 1947. Again quoting, you can expect a program for reviving business in Western Germany to be pushed by all U.S. factions. Republican backing was assured when John Foster Dulles, Republican spokesman, recently called for the revival of business in Germany and Western Europe, whatever the price. German goods are already trickling into the U.S. market. Anticipating some consumer resistance in the U.S., military government authorities have shrewdly met customs requirements by marking them Made in Germany, U.S. Zone. Before large-scale arrivals of German goods begin, Washington is likely to release a press barrage explaining that German exports help pay U.S. occupation costs in Germany, unquote. Shortly after its founding, the Committee for the Marshall Plan placed full-page advertisements in the most influential U.S. newspapers, sent thousands of personally addressed telegrams signed by the former Secretary of War, Henry L. Stimson, to businessmen asking for their donations and political support, and made a mass mailing to hundreds of thousands of U.S., quote, opinion leaders, unquote, in the upper strata of business, media, labor, and social organizations. The group chartered Marshall Plan clubs in a dozen cities, opened business offices in New York and Washington, and initiated a series of heavily publicized meetings between President Truman and business leaders designed to convey the impression of broad popular support for the Marshall Plan. As Congressman Charles Plumlee, a Republican from Vermont, put it, quote, "There has never been so much propaganda in the whole history of the nation as there has been for the Marshall Plan," unquote. The campaign created a, quote, "overwhelming conviction among the American people and among members of Congress that we must have the Marshall Plan right now," unquote, he continued. The claim of overwhelming support, unquote, was in fact overblown. Public opinion polls of the period indicate that about 65% of the U.S. population either opposed the Marshall Plan or did not know what it was. Even so, the Marshall Plan passed the Congress by a large margin. The plan sponsored used the relatively broad popular support for doing something constructive about Europe as a means of putting through the distinctly unpopular idea of reestablishing the German economic elite. And that economic elite was indeed reestablished, turning once again to Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson. The German economic elite and corporations that had been active under Hitler have continued for the most part, though without the Nazi rhetoric and police state powers of the Nazi period. There were, of course, generational changes in the leadership of German companies in the years following the war, and other reforms took place in response to pressure from German unions and international competition. But the fundamental pattern in German finance and industry has been continuity and stability. And the restoration or perpetuation of the German financial and industrial elite by their American compatriots on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I consider to be the dominant force in the 20th century ultimately set the stage for not only the perpetuation of the Bormann organization. An attempt to interdict that organization was deep six at the end of World War II. But it set the stage for the next major capital flow, the fifth capital flow, which goes from the 750 Bormann corporate fronts in neutral countries back into Germany to help with the West German economic revival in the mid-1950s. This fifth capital flow in this hydraulic paradigm that we're looking at is described by Paul Manning as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Money continued to trickle into West German firms from the private investment sector during the late 40s, but not until May 5, 1955, when the Federal Republic of Germany became a sovereign government and the Allied occupation forces had left, did the enormous sums shifted from the Third Reich away from threatened Allied seizure become available to those groups in West Germany that had participated in Martin Bormann's program of flight capital. And of the status of the Bormann organization as of 1981, a major player in the world economic situation, Paul Manning writes as follows. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse, by the way, this as of 1981, is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Skipping down, what will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the higher echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And the power of that organization comes from these capital flows in the 20th century. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.